Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Thank you to everyone who's been listening to the show, telling a friend, subscribing, all that kind of stuff. First and foremost, I hope everyone is as good as they possibly can be right now. Yeah, just hope everyone is good and safe. This episode that you're going to listen to, it's another one of the Prince Edward County winemakers. This is Colin Stanners from Stanners in Prince Edward County, obviously. Another classic Pinot Noir and Chardonnay producer. And they do some pretty good Pinot Gris. I bought some of the Pinot Gris. And it's funny, when I did these interviews, it was a little over a month ago. It was like family day. And that feels like just in a different lifetime, like just driving around to the different wineries and just hanging out and talking and being around people. You certainly miss that kind of stuff right now. You take it for granted. So a couple thoughts before we get to the podcast. I wanted to first say some other ones coming. J.P. Collat, one of the famous winemakers in Niagara at 13th Street. He's got a hell of a story. Lenz Moser, and for people who don't know, the Moser family is one of, if not the most famous winemakers in Austria. And he's got an interesting journey. He's making wine in China. And when we, no doubt, you'll believe this, when we did the interview, this was before coronavirus was really starting to be a thing. It was certainly going on in Wuhan, but by this point, it still hadn't been a huge story here in Canada. It was still in its early stages. And he is making some of the best wines in China. So he'll be coming up. Corey Beck, the winemaker for Francis Ford Coppola. So those are a couple that are on its way. The one thing I've noticed, and I wonder about you guys as well, you're getting a lot more mail from, a lot more email. Of course, it's email. It's not mail. I mean, it was the last time anyone, you know, wrote a letter. But what I'm seeing in my inbox is all these consignment companies that I'm, you know, that I'm signed up for. And there's a lot of them I've never even ordered any wine from, especially some of the bigger high-end ones. But they're now all sending you messaging saying, hey, ready to drink now Cabernet, you know, because people are running out of wine. You know, it can be harder to go to the store to pick up wine. So like, hey, it's here for you and it's ready to drink now. You know, I think, as I said before, I think people are drinking more today than they were even a couple months ago. And yeah, I'm getting a lot more emails from consignment companies. And again, I'm a big fan. I hope if you have the money, that's the big conceit on the front end. If you have the money for it, because wine is a luxury. It's always been a luxury. It's more of a luxury now, considering how many people are out of work and how many people are applying for unemployment. But if you can, wine online is a great one. You know, I know wineonline.ca, excuse me, and then the Wine Online website, they've got some ones out there. One of my own personal favorites, who I've done a lot of interviews with the winemakers, Barrel Select, a smaller family run, it's two people, it's Jeff and Don. They got a great wine list. I've bought tons from them in the past. So yeah, Barrel Select. And again, a reminder to go out if you can, support restaurants. I went to my favorite little pizza place recently and grabbed, we grabbed some pizza, some pasta, and a bottle of Super Tuscan. I wanted to give a quick shout out to Croatia. I was opened up a bottle from the Degoc area, which is like the most famous region in Croatia for red wine. The grape is Plavik Mali. I think I pronounced that correctly. The area, I'm sure I still screwed up. And it was this 09 Reserva, 100% Plavik Mali. And what's great about this wine is it's like, these are big wines. These are 14.5, 15.5 alcohol wines. And usually, if you've listened to this, you know, I much prefer the 12%, maybe 13% for my reds. But this, you know, 11 years, that's some time for it, but you know, it could have been aged, it could have actually aged a lot longer, but after 11 years, it was really smooth. And, you know, raisin and dried blueberry, dried black fruit, spice, it tasted a little bit like a mini Amarone. If you get a chance, if you just see somewhere, wherever you buy your wine, if you see Plavik Mali, give it a shot. And, you know, if it's a good producer, they will be able, even with high alcohol, to make a balanced wine where you're not just tasting the heat from the booze. So just a little mini shout out, a little mini recommendation. All right. That is it for me. We're now going to get into Colin Stanners, who's been making wine for close to 20 years in Prince Edward County, a really interesting guy. And trust me, I have a bunch of his Chards, Pinot Gris, and Pinot Noirs. He makes some really good stuff, especially single vineyard Pinot Noir. Anyway, enjoy. And again, everyone, take care and be safe.
The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. My third interview, or kind of technically my fourth, in Prince Edward County, one of my favorite places. I am at Stanners. I am talking with the owner, winemaker, Colin Stanners. Colin, thank you so much for doing this.
Oh, thanks. This is great.
So, you know, I got all these questions I want to talk to you about your wine, your journey, Prince Edward County. But before we started, I was telling you that I had a dream last night that all these interviews I did, they didn't save, or there's something wrong with them. And in my normal job in radio, I'll sometimes have a dream, like a nightmare, that guests don't call in. Or I used to do theater, and then the classic dream is I don't remember my lines. Do you have winemaker-related bad dreams? Like, what is the winemaker version of, I went to school and I was only wearing my underpants?
I usually have tasting-related nightmares. So usually it's that I come to the tasting room and it's completely unprepared and I can't find the right glasses for people.
Yeah. So that would be such an innocuous dream. The place is filled and you spend the whole dream looking for glasses.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And by the way, what is the name of that is Oliver? That's your dog?
Yeah.
And Oliver will, of course, be a part of this podcast as well. So you moved to California in 1990, studying at the University, UC Davis, University of California, Davis. That's
I was a chemist. Mm-hmm. So I moved to California to do a postdoc at UC Berkeley.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I was at Berkeley for 4 years and then got a job at some startup companies in the area. So we ended up staying there for 16 years.
Yeah. Okay. So I had UC Davis. That can
so, be. So I did. So once I started getting used to wine, I was making wine at home and I did take like an introductory course at UC Davis in winemaking.
Well, what
but
got,
it wasn't
what,
the full thing.
What got you into wine? Like, was there a moment when you decided this is, cause you said being a chemist. How did it go from chemist? I mean, there are similarities, but how did it go from chemist to winemaker?
Well, I guess I started drinking a lot of wine was the main thing and really enjoying it, especially Pinot Noir. So that drove me to try making it at home. And I could get really good grapes from areas around there. So like from Santa Cruz Mountains, I was really close to that. And Russian River, Anderson Valley, which is a little further north. So I had good material. And so I tried making wine out of it and I really enjoyed it.
How are those first wines? Like as a winemaker in 2020, if you think back to the ones you made in the mid-90s, how would 2020, Colin, how would you describe those wines?
Well, I was experimenting. So actually the first thing I learned was when we went out to pick, I had the idea that the best, like the really clean, perfect looking clusters were the things that I wanted.
Yeah.
So
that makes sense when you get started.
So I take them home and then crush it and it'd be like 20 bricks or something, or some ridiculous number for a California wine.
Right? Yeah.
So I made some, they turned out quite well. So one was the first one I made was a Zinfandel and then a Pinot Noir. Both with, by California standards, very unripe fruit because I picked the ones that look perfect.
Yeah.
And, But yeah, they were nice wines, actually.
Real quick, because it's with this podcast, I always straddle between. I know that some people that listen are hardcore wine, other people that are getting into it. If you could just explain, just quick, just you know, in the what Brix means for when you're picking your grapes.
Yeah, that's the sugar content by weight. Mm-hmm. So it means 20% sugar.
Yeah. And for you, what's ideal for here for this? For this terroir, what's your ideal?
Well, so that's interesting. So here, you know, with Pinot Noir, I'm, you know, it's great if it's 21.5, but often it will be as low as 20. And here you can make, though, a really good wine at the lower Brix levels. Mm-hmm. In California, in a hot area, it turns out that you don't really develop a lot of interesting flavors in the grapes until they get to much higher Brix levels.
Yeah.
So typically, people are picking there at 24, 25,
that's
26
pretty good.
Brix. Ooh. Yeah. So, which of course make all that sugar turns into alcohol. So those are much more alcoholic wines than we have here, but they kind of need to in order to get the flavors.
Yeah.
So when I came here, so I was used to that. And then coming here, I was shocked at the first few harvests when the Brix were as low as they were, you know, in the very low 20s, but then really surprised at how flavorful the wines are. So.
How much of an adjustment do you think that is for people that maybe grew up, because there's more of it, there's more California wine, there's more California Pinot, people who grew up with those bigger California Pinots. I'm not saying that to be, I'm not going bigger in a bad way, you know, because as you said, that's the geography, that's the climate. But just adjusting from drinking those to then trying Prince Edward County Pinot, which is very different in terms of profile.
Yeah, I think it's a big adjustment for people. So for me, and now that I've drinking a lot of Prince Edward County Pinots, I really can't stand drinking California ones or those really much bigger ones.
That's kind of where I wanted to go to next.
In general, you know, I think in general, a lot of people that are coming into the tasting room that aren't necessarily Pinot fans do have the idea that a red wine is supposed to be really big and full of tannin because they are used to drinking, you know, Merlots and Syrahs and things from very warm climates. And so that is, I think they are surprised at how light the wine is. So that is an issue that I think as an Ontario winemaker, we have to deal with that and educate people that just because it's a light wine doesn't mean that it's an inferior wine.
Yeah. Isn't it interesting just how our tastes change? I've talked about a lot on this podcast. I used to buy Costa Brown all the time. And then I woke up one day and I tried a bottle. And I could tell, okay, this is a well-made product. There's a lot of time and attention and care, but it was too big. And the alcohol was over 15%. I'm like, oh no, I better let these sit for another decade and maybe they'll mellow out. And just my shift had changed to more of a cool climate style of Pinot. I always find it interesting just how we can have these swings in our own taste buds.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And so like I was saying, when I was in California, I really enjoyed the California wines. I worked with some people that were from all over different parts of the country. So there's one French guy who said, oh, he loved living in California, but the one thing he hated was that the wine was so bad. And I thought that he was, I mean, I couldn't really see how that could be true. Although now that I'm here and drinking much different types of wines, I can see that, it is what you get used to. Mm-hmm. And also I was at some tastings where, we tasted a lot of New Zealand wines against Ontario wines. And you could really see, I was really taken aback with the amount of tannin and the extraction that are in those wines compared with Ontario wines. And it was hard for me to imagine drinking more than a few glasses of some of those wines because they were so tannic.
Yeah, I find especially a lot of the Central Otago ones can be, you know, can really be, as you say, big.
It makes you wonder, yeah, so should I have more tannin in my wines?
No, you've had plenty of, you know what, here's the thing. I'm glad I live in a world where Costa Brown exists and where Stanners exists, and everyone just, you know, what you love today, you might not love 10 years from now. And there is good California Pinot, but I find you really got to seek it out and just find where is the coldest areas in Napa or Sonoma that they are sourcing their grapes. And those are the areas that I'd probably, just with my profile at as a 44-year-old, I would enjoy more.
Great. Yeah.
So I jumped ahead. Bad host here. I want to go back 17 years. You bought the land here, I believe, in 2003, planted in 2005, and your first vintage was 2009. Is my research better there than it was on the UC Davis stuff?
Yes, that's true. I did make a little bit of wine, a little bit of Pinot from 2008 as well.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I always say our first decent-sized vintage is 2009.
I'm curious, what did 2009 look like? What did it feel like for you taking on, you know, this a pretty significant undertaking?
It was a very exciting year. It turned out to be quite a good one. It was fairly cool, but really good for Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. So it was exciting to get a decent yield. Mm-hmm. One of the things we struggle with here in the county is that we always have, you know, 1.5 tons or 2 tons per acre type of yield. So, and back in the early days, we were still learning how to manage the vineyard and doing it organically back then as well, which was tough. So I was very excited then that we had some grapes to work with.
What made you choose the site?
Well, what we were looking for first is the soil. So we have the Hillier clay loam, and one of the good things about this area is that there's fractured limestone underneath as opposed to solid bedrock. So there's only like 2 to 2, 3, 4 feet of soil on top.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start hitting layers of limestone. So if it's solid, you can have you have a limited soil depth for one thing, and you can have some issues with drainage. If it's all cracked up, then the roots can go down through that, and it's better for drainage. So this whole area of Hillier has that feature, whereas that's not true of some of the other places. The other thing is we wanted to be a little bit off of close to the lake to moderate the weather so that we have less problem from spring frosts and fall frosts. But you want to be a little bit off the lake so that it's warmer in the summer. If you're right on the lake, it actually is significantly colder.
Right, yeah.
So that's kind of how we arrived at this area.
It's almost like Goldilocks and the Three Bears, you know. The porridge, you don't want it too hot or too cold. You want it just right.
Yeah.
I asked Dan Sullivan this, so I'm going to ask you this as well. What is it about, like, is it just, it, maybe it's just a mystery. What is it about limestone that is one of the secret sauce in terms of making great Pinot or great Chardonnay?
That's a good question. I personally think it's mostly a mystery and an observation that
comes up over and over again. Like Burgundy is like that. I mean,
yeah. It's been a while, but if I remember correctly, some of the things I heard that were trying to explain it in a scientific way was that there are ions in the soil that bind to the roots, to the there's little hairs on the roots, and mm-hmm. it helps with transporting nutrients across the roots and things like that, and so that the limestone has the right type of ions to help with that.
Okay.
But I don't know, really the case or not.
Dan was kind of like, wasn't sure himself. And this is the first time that's the first science answer I've heard. And maybe there isn't one. It's just part of the deal. But, you know, it seems like you can trace the map in Burgundy and where the Grand Cru and Premier Cru is, where more of the fractured limestone, as you mentioned, is just lying. So there's something about it.
It seems like you want limestone and you need to have a certain clay and loam content as well.
So
not just straight sand or rock. There has to be something in there that can hold water.
All right, I want to continue now on the soil conversation with you. And part of it is, I've studied wine. I'm a wine geek, and part of it is I think it's important to raise the profile of this area to make people realize that it is a special area, and it's not, oh, Prince Edward County, the wine's going to taste like this. That geography matters, even by a kilometer or two. And I was wondering, and this might be a tricky question, the differences in the styles of wine, if it is here in Hillier, or say the central part of Hough, or say down south where Long Dog is. Like, there are distinctive areas, part of it proximity to the lake. Like, can you describe the differences in the styles of wines depending on where in Prince Edward County you set up shop?
I think that's starting to emerge. I mean, of course, there are differences stylistically with winemakers that make a difference as well. I find that the wines from the South Bay region, I think it's a bit warmer there than here, so they do tend to be a little bigger, a little more tannin in it, mm-hmm. than from Hillier, where I think we're a little, I would say we're more floral and more mineral tasting, and a bit lighter, yeah. A little bit less tannin.
Let's go to the Judgment. And like every place has one of the, you guys did the Judgment of Kingston in 2019, and it was Pinot versus Pinot. It was you guys versus New Zealand, right?
Yes, that's right. Yes, they had three county Pinots, mm-hmm. and three New Zealand Pinots. Tasted blind.
And congratulations.
Thank you very much.
You guys were the gold medal winner. And I was reading this quote about it's really good because it gives people the chance to see how good Ontario and Prince Edward County wines are relative to the international wines. I was wondering if you'd take me back to that day, to that night, that moment. Just what was that all about? How did that go for you?
Well, first I should say I wasn't actually there. So it was my dad.
Yeah. Oh, really?
There. Yeah. So my mom and dad were also in this venture.
Yeah.
And
that's fantastic.
And owners of the winery as well as myself and Mary.
Oh, okay.
So I was actually at a fundraiser dinner that night, and my dad was at the Judgment of Kingston. But he described it to me. And.
And what was it? What? How was his night?
He really enjoyed it. He thought it was a very good event. It was the kind of thing where the tension was building because, the judges, I guess the bronze and the silver were already determined, and they were. New Zealand, mm-hmm. and
you don't want it.
So there's a lot of tension in the room because clearly all the wines were really good. So it's like people were getting disappointed, and then when they announced that we had won the gold, it was just like everybody was so happy.
Yeah,
there was a big cheer, and patting him on the back.
Yeah, just that congratulations. Sense of relief,
So
now where were you? Sorry, where were you again that night?
I was at a fundraiser dinner for the Bird Observatory here.
The life of a winemaker. You're always doing something. Okay, let's go back then for a second. How important was your family, your family structure, to helping Stanners get to where it is today?
Oh, very important. Yeah, especially early on, my parents were very involved. They were the ones that actually found this area while Mary and I were in California, mm-hmm. and we did a bunch of research together. As he loves Pinot Noir as well, so we did a bunch of research together as to what clones and stuff we should plant. And my parents actually looked after the first acre that was planted before Mary and I moved here.
So your parents were always, they were into wine before you were?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So my dad made wine at home as well.
Yeah. Oh, okay. And what's your dad's homemade wine like?
It's very good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What is, and so he makes Pinot at home?
He made a whole bunch of different things, mm-hmm. different wines, not just Pinot.
So then that was like... I guess that played a big part of your influence. You grew up with wine because some of these interviews I do, some of them, their parents love wine. Some of them, they're agnostic to it. Others couldn't stand it. I'm always just curious about the winemaker's journey.
Yeah, that was sort of, he, my parents actually started getting interested in wine later in their life. So not when I was a little kid. There wasn't any good wine whatsoever around. It was more when I was, you know, when I was 18, 19 and studying to drink. At around that same time, my dad was starting to get into wine as well. It was later.
Yeah. So. I didn't start getting until after I was 25. When I was 24, if someone said Merlot, I'm like, is that an Italian wine? You know, yeah. So yes. We all come at it at a different age.
Yeah, so similar to me, really. It wasn't really until moving to California that, you know, having the wine country there and doing a lot of visiting there. And plus, it was very easy to get really good Burgundies from private wine shops there. So.
There is nothing more infuriating than, like, I'll talk to people who loved wine in the 80s, and they go, oh, yeah, we could get a second growth for $8. And I just sit there and I get so angry. I bet you, like just how much, I always hate those stories because I'm jealous because I wish I lived in that world.
So there was one store where I did a lot of my, you know, research, I guess, trying different Pinot Noirs from different areas of Burgundy.
Yeah.
And, you know, it wasn't incredibly cheap, but, you know, I was getting Premier Crus, and he would age, and they'd be aged as well. So, like, 7-year-old, you know, Premier Cru for, like, $35, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Even adjusted through inflation, that's incredible.
Yeah.
That's a good deal. Was there, and if you don't have an answer, it's always a tricky question, because our memory's a weird thing. Do you have a favorite bottle? Was there a moment where you drank it and you went, all right, yep, I've always enjoyed wine, but this bottle is confirmed. This is what I need to spend my life trying to make.
Well, I guess the closest thing I had to that was when I was making, so I was making my own wine at home. So I had the grapes, I was pressing, and I opened a really nice bottle of Pinot. And it was a Volnay and a Leroy. So I had that while doing the pressing, and it was like, wow, this is great.
Yeah.
So I think I've got to do this.
Yeah. That must have been a wonderful day or night when you were doing that.
Yeah.
That's a great story. When you were talking, like in the interviews I read from you about the judgment of Kingston, one of the themes that came up is perception. Where do you think the perception, let's first start within Canada. What do you think the perception is of Prince Edward County? What's the perception of the wines made here?
Well, I think for the average person in Ontario, they don't really, still don't really know that much about the county. And it's still, like I was saying earlier, they still have this feeling that Ontario produces, it can't produce a good wine. So that's one of the reasons why events like, I think, the Judgment of Kingston are so great, where people can actually taste them blind against some of the wines which they think are great, and then just see how they compare. So I think that's the whole Ontario wine industry, I think, has to deal with this negative perception that we have here in Ontario, which is really kind of surprising.
Yeah.
But, on the other hand, the people that are, you know, wine critics and wine writers have been very supportive of Prince Edward County and have recognized, I think, what it's capable of. And so it's been really great in that we've come a long way here in a very short period of time. And
yeah.
So I'm happy for that.
Yeah, it's always the reminder about trying to compare. Like, I've done tastings of Prince Edward County Chardonnays, and people have thrown in some Premier Cru Burgundy. And they've, you know, some of them have been able to go toe-to-toe with it. And I think the one thing I always got to remind people is, you know, Burgundy's been around for a couple hundred years longer. They've had longer to map out every square inch.
Yeah, that's right. So, like, really, we've only been here for about 20 years or so. And so it's really quite amazing, the progress that we've made.
How different of a winemaker are you now versus when you got started about a decade ago? Do you notice any changes in yourself in terms of what you're doing either in the field or in the winery?
Certainly in the field, I've learned quite a bit in the field. We do a lot more leaf pulling than we did in the past. Also with Pinot Noir, I think it's very important to not have preconceived notions of what Brix level you want to get to. Mm-hmm. It's more like the grapes pretty much tell you themselves when they want to get picked.
Yeah.
And if you wait beyond that, they're starting to fall apart, then that's a problem. And so now I always pick when the grapes tell me, oh yeah, we're ready, and please don't wait much more than a couple more days.
What does that look like? What is that? When you say the grapes tell me when it's time, what does that look like?
Well, so you always have a distribution of ripeness, and then the clusters that are the ripest start to get soft, berries will start falling off the cluster, and then eventually they'll start getting moldy. So when they're getting soft like that, then you know it's time. You better get them.
Yeah, so not big and beautiful looking grapes like you thought.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, well, that's right. Yes, actually, yeah, the best wine comes from some, you know, gnarly things that are shriveled up. And
yeah, it's funny how that works. When it gets, we talk about the extremes here, and I've talked to a bunch of the winemakers about the freeze in 2015. What do you do here when the weather gets extreme, the snow or the cold? What are some of the techniques you do to try to protect the vines?
Well, for frost, we have a wind machine, which is basically a big fan that mixes in warmer air that's up higher. Usually when there's frost, it's early in the morning, before the sun comes up, is the worst time. And there's really cold air down at ground level. It's like 4 degrees, 5 degrees warmer up above. So if you mix that in,
right,
then you can make a 3 or 4 degree difference. And that's usually all that you need.
Yeah.
Although in 2015, you know, it was beyond what the wind machine could manage. Although it did, for us, it still protected a portion of the vineyard, but not the entire.
What percentage did you lose in 15?
Oh, I think we lost about two thirds. So we only got about a third.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm hearing from everyone.
Yeah.
You know, from almost 100% loss to 75% loss.
Yeah. In the winter, we're burying canes. So we select the canes after harvest that we want to protect, that have they have the buds that are going to produce the growth and the fruit for the next year.
Mm-hmm.
We tie them down to a wire that we have at ground level, and then plow up as much dirt as we can over top.
Yeah.
We started trying some of the geotextile fabric as well. So we'll see how, this is the first year for that. So we'll see how that goes.
Yeah. I heard you talk about when you were in the first couple of years, a retired farmer nearby helped you guys out. I'm curious, what is the spirit of cooperation? How prevalent is that in the county?
We all help each other out. Like when we got here, I didn't know how to grow grapes really. And, so we would all of us were in the same boat pretty much. I mean, there are people that knew more about growing grapes, but it's quite different in the county, because of this having to bury. So it's a completely different training system and, mm-hmm. and trellising system. And so there'd be meeting, we'd have meetings about every 2 weeks where we'd all get together, with someone from, OMAFRA, the Ontario Ministry of Agriculture, and talk about our problems and how to solve them.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, we're lucky enough that one of our neighbors is a farmer. And so for things like learning how to properly put a cultivator on a tractor and make sure it's lined up and plows and things, he would come over and help us with that. So that was great.
But those little things are so, things are big things. That's so important.
And we also have a welder, which is just down the street, mm-hmm. who's done farm equipment all his life as well. So that really helps too. So we have custom plows and things, and it's just really easy. We just go down the street and he can weld them up. And
yeah. Your 2017 Pinot Noir, your Prince Edward County Pinot, I think that was the one that won that competition.
Yeah. The 2017 Narrow Rose.
Narrow Pinot Rose. Noir. I want to talk to you about Narrow Rose in a moment, but just, I know John Szabo loved that wine. Jamie Good loved that wine. What was it about 2017? What was it about the winemaking that just that made? It's not that other years and other vintages aren't great. You've survived and you've been successful for a long time, so you got a lot of good vintages. What was it just about 17 that seemed to strike a chord with a lot of people?
Yeah, I think it's mostly, you know, there's a lot of variation in weather here, and which is one of the interesting things about being a winemaker in Ontario. And so 17 was a interesting year in that it started off really cold and wet, but if you survive the first part, then it got really nice and warm in September and October. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting combination, and it was actually quite hot. So it was hot and dry at harvest time. It was an interesting combination of having the ripe flavors there from all that heat we had at the end. Yet, since overall it was still a fairly cool year, there's pretty high acidity as well. So yeah. It's an interesting combination of having the ripe flavors there with the acidity. So there's nice tension, I guess, in the wine from that.
Again, if I'm going to copy myself, it feels, again, like the Goldilocks and the Three Bears. But I'll use another one, you know, the bed too hard, the bed too soft, and the bed just right, where you had the heat, but you also had the coolness to allow for the acidity.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Narrow Rose. It's funny, there's a Prince Edward County Facebook page, and I mentioned who I was coming to interview, and one of the questions was, hey, make sure to ask about the Narrow Rose program. And for people who don't know, just what is the advantage when you are planting all your vines and they're a lot closer together than maybe in other traditional New World wineries?
So the theory is that since they're close, really close together, there's not a lot of room for the roots to stay along the surface and go laterally, so it kind of forces them to go down deeper.
Yeah,
which is good in that they become more drought resistant, and it's supposed to be good for flavors to have them deep down into the limestone. There's the other thing is that each vine doesn't have to have very much fruit, mm-hmm. because there's so many. So you only need to have a few clusters on each vine, and you still have a decent amount over the whole area. So again, because of that, the grapes that are on it tend to be more concentrated in flavors. And then it also turns out that there's less airflow in there. So on the good side, that it gets hotter. Mm-hmm. In the vineyard, so it tends to get ripe faster than our other blocks. So our narrow rows are 4.5 feet between the rows and 3 feet between vines within a row.
And how does that compare to, say, a more traditional, lesser, tightly packed vineyard?
Typically, there's 9 feet between rows.
Okay. Yeah.
And 4 feet between vines.
Okay. Yeah. That is. Yeah.
So it's quite a big difference.
Yeah.
So one is around, you know, one is sort of close to 1,000-ish vines per acre, and ours is up in the 3,400 kind of vines per acre.
I saw an interview or a speech you were doing on YouTube. That's how I spent my Friday night, was watching wine videos. And you talked about just the how much there's twice as much grapes grown, it costs twice as much to grow grapes in Prince Edward County than in Niagara. I'm curious the reasons behind that.
Well, there's a couple of main ones. The main one is in Niagara, they don't have to bury canes for winter protection. Mm-hmm. So for us, there's a lot of extra work.
It's just because it's the microclimates there are warmer there?
Yeah, it's just mm-hmm. that much warmer, just a little bit warmer in the winter. So it's not that common for them to get damaging winter. So the magic temperature is around minus 22. So mm-hmm. if it gets below minus 22, then it starts to kill off the buds in most of the varietals. Mm-hmm. So here that happens pretty much every winter, not every winter, but you know, maybe 4 out of 5 or something.
Yeah.
And there it's kind of the reverse, the other way around. If maybe 1 out of 5 it happens, and then they get some damage, but they live with that because it's a lot easier than all the extra work you have to do to bury the canes. So for example, after We have three people that are working out there. So for our vineyard, it takes them a month of working every day, 9 or 10 hours a day to get all those canes tied down. So that's quite a bit of extra labor. And then you have about the same amount again in the springtime when you go to pull them up.
Right.
And then also our yields here are extremely low. So it's very rare for anybody in Niagara or any other growing region in the world to have a yield that's below 3 tons per acre. And a lot of the times it's more like 4 or 5. Whereas here we're kind of averaging 1.5 tons per acre. Yeah. And part of that, again, when you're burying these canes, there's lots of rocks in the soil, all this fractured limestone. So we're sort of piling rocks on top of the poor vines. And then there's a lot of, there's a lot of handling of the canes too. So as you're trying to tie them up, you knock some buds off. And so not every one of them lives through that process.
Right.
That's one of the reasons we're kind of limited to. In the best year, I think we've had around 2.5 tons we can get, but average with the weather problems that we have,
right?
If your yield is 1.5 tons instead of 3, I mean, you spent just as much labor in there,
but you're only getting half as many grapes.
That
makes total sense. What's the physical toll? What is the physical toll of being a winemaker? Like, whenever I interview a football player, I'm always curious. What does Monday or Tuesday morning feel like when you get out of bed? What does it feel like to be a winemaker in the middle of harvest and, like, the day after harvest?
Yeah, it's pretty hard. So it's there are very long days, and we're all, we're picking up a lot of heavy things and moving things around. So it's very physically tiring. Like, for me, I do have some help. My brother helps me, but we pick into picking flats.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all hand picked.
Yep.
So often I'll be out. If I'm feeling up to it, then I'm out in the daytime picking with the rest of the crew so that we can pick as much as possible. Then we rush back. And all these bins, so they each weigh around, 25 pounds or something, right? And we might have picked a few tons. And so then we're moving we load these onto a pallet, and then they get moved around, and then I dump, and then we destem them that evening. So there's, we have to do a bunch of cleaning with a pressure washer to get everything nice and clean. Then we're lifting and dumping these bins into the destemmer. So it's quite physically tiring.
Yeah.
And so that happens over and over. And then there's punch downs to be done. And so usually when I wake up in the morning, I'm extremely tired. But then once you get going, it's exciting. So
yeah.
You're kind of going on adrenaline. And then when it's all over, it's like this big crash. It's like, okay, what do I do now? It's also like a post-harvest depression kind of thing.
Yeah, you have more time. And yeah. And also just the endorphin rush of doing that work and getting it done. How good does it feel? Like there's the physical toll, but when it's all done, and we're in your lovely little tasting room here, and I see a bunch of your bottles that I want to talk about the wines. But just that feeling when someone tries your wine and goes, well, that's damn good. I mean, you must have a real nice... There has to be a sense of pride and ownership because, as you just said, some days you're the guy out there helping to pick the grapes.
Yeah, yeah. It does feel really good. And I think it's that kind of feedback that helps keep you going.
Yeah.
Right? And people saying, people emailing and said, oh, we just had this for our anniversary and it was amazing.
It's like, nice.
Thank you.
Yes. That nice.
That's like, kind of why we do it, So to celebrate life, right? So
that must be so rewarding knowing that another two people, enjoying their best moments, your wine has helped make that moment go, well, that's got to be great.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
that's kind of,
Well, you know what? I might get back to some non-interventionist stuff, and I've got nerdy questions. But I was wondering if you could just sort of go over, like, just some of the wines. Like, obviously you guys are first a Pinot and Chardonnay house. Just what, yeah. If you were going to describe what Stanners is in terms of the product you make, how would you describe it?
Yeah, so we mostly focus on Pinot. So we have Pinot Noir, like you said, and then Chardonnay. I also make a Pinot Gris, mm-hmm. Which I give about 3 days of skin contact to. So it's a coppery orange color and has some different flavors. So that's a pretty popular one. And then to round out our varietals, I make a Cabernet Franc. Mm-hmm. We don't have any of our own Cab Franc planted, so those are all from grapes that I purchased from other vineyards.
Around here or Niagara?
Historically, it's been from both. Mm-hmm. I have a standing contract with a grower in Niagara, so I always can get the Niagara Cab Franc. I can't always get County Cab Franc, though. Especially mm-hmm. these days, it seems to be in high demand. So I'm going to have to plant my own at some point. I originally did not plant it because I thought we didn't have enough heat to get it ripe. But,
oh, yeah?
But turns out that we can make some really nice...
Is that something you're thinking about doing for the future? Is just the state-grown Cab Franc?
Yes, I'm hoping, yeah.
It seems like that is definitely... And, you know, there's Pearl Merced does a great job. There's a bunch of really good ones out there. It feels like Cab Franc is definitely the grape that has been on the rise over the last couple of years.
Yeah, I think it does really well in Ontario. And, you know, I make it in a, I would say, a lighter style. So I make it like the Pinot Noir. So I destem, and there's a lot of whole berries. So there's mm-hmm. no crushing, a lot yeah. of whole berries during fermentation. So it's a longer and lower temperature fermentation. So it really brings out the fruit flavors of it. So it pushes it, I think, a little away from being more vegetative mm-hmm. and more fruity and not quite so much tannin. And I'm using older barrels, so I'm not adding oak tannins as well. So yeah, so it's a little different. It's a different version than kind of trying to make it into a big wine. And I think it works really well for Ontario.
Yeah, I've been enjoying it. And yeah, that sometimes that green stalkiness, I'm not a fan of. Yeah. Not that, you know, there's great ones in Loire, but when it gets a little too stalky, that's just my own personal preference. It just doesn't jive with me as well. Yeah. Whole berry fermentation. We'll get nerdy for a second again.
Yeah.
I know your reasons behind using that technique, and if you could explain to people, because sometimes, you know, a group will be at a winery and they'll be at a tasting and they'll hear the line, "We do whole berry fermentation."
Right.
Everyone nods their head and then you move on. And then they're like, "Wait a minute, what does that mean?" I was wondering if you could explain to people.
Yeah, sure. So there's probably different opinions, of course, what it does. But
yeah.
For the reason I do it, so especially here in the county, making wine is a matter of balancing the fruitiness or the perceived sweetness with tannins and acidity and alcohol. And so we have pretty high acidity. So I'm trying to do something that preserves and keeps the fruitiness there. And so... So I destem, which gets rid of the stems, because the stems, especially in a colder climate, tend to have fairly harsh tannins, so you don't really want to include them in the fermentation. And then I don't crush, but during the process of the destemming, some of the berries will get broken up anyway, so there is juice there. So at the start of fermentation, so if you crush, there's more surface area of skins, and more of the juice and the sugars are available right away for the fermentation to take place. So what tends to happen is that the yeast can multiply quite rapidly, and that fermentation can go quite quickly and go up to a higher temperature because they're happy and there's tons of sugar there. When there's whole berries at the start, there's sort of a fermentation that's happening inside, which is much slower. And then as the berries are decomposing, then more sugar is sort of released. And so it tends to make the fermentation go longer mm-hmm. and the yeast population builds up a little more slowly. And then you end up not going to quite as high a temperature. When you go to higher temperatures, you tend to blow off some of the, fruity aromas and the fragrant aromas, And you can also, at the higher temperature, you can extract more tannin from the skin. So you make kind of a more tannic, darker fruit or dried fruit type wine from that. So anyway, I guess my own personal preference is to the more fragrant, fresher fruit.
Yeah.
And I think that balances a little better with the high acidity that we have here in our vineyard.
And which wines do you use that technique for? Is it for across the board? Is it more
It's across the board, yeah.
Yeah.
So I do that as well for the Cab Franc and the Pinot Noir. Mm-hmm. For the whites, I'm also usually giving some skin contact. I like to try to get some complexity out of them, as opposed to making a less complex, fruitier white.
Okay, so Chardonnay also sees a little bit of skin contact?
Yeah, it usually sees a day.
Okay, and the Pinot Gris, 3 days,
and the
Chardonnay, one.
Yeah.
How important is it for you to be as non-interventionist as possible when it comes to making wine?
Pretty important for me. I mean, if I have to do something because there's something going wrong, then I will. But I find that the less you handle the wine, the better it's likely to be, and the more it preserves the terroir features that are in the grapes. So if I'm trying to make a wine that really shows where it's grown from, or shows what the weather conditions were like that year, I think it's best if you're not really handling it or adding. I'm not adding anything extra. I do use some yeasts, so I'm adding some yeast, and I do use sulfites at various stages.
Which is pretty common.
Which is,
incredibly common.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, in fact, it's the majority is
yes.
I never thought about this. I think, there's people that want complete, natural, organic, and all that, and I understand it, but can you help to dispel the fear of sulfur, or the fear of sulfites? Because I always try to explain to people, the top houses in Bordeaux or Burgundy, there's going to be sulfites. It's just kind of making wine.
Yeah, it's always been part of making wine. Without it, it's pretty difficult to make a wine that doesn't have some oxidized flavors and or a wine that will age well. So pretty much every wine has some amount of sulfurs and sulfites added to it. I mean, and of course, one can go overboard. So typically you would find a lot higher sulfur levels in mass-produced wines that are going all around the world because they have to make sure it's super stable.
Yeah.
So one of the things that sulfites do is make sure that there aren't microorganisms that can grow in the wine and create off flavors. And the other thing it does is help keep the keep it from oxidizing. But when used in small amounts, it doesn't really affect the flavor in any way. And so we're talking parts per million, right? These wines, and does make a tastier wine.
Well, I mean, the proof is in the success you've had. I'll leave you with this. Obviously, maybe one of the goals for the next couple of years is starting your own Cab Franc program. I always usually end the interview with, where do you hope to be? I mean, you've been doing this since the mid-2000s. Where would you like to be in the mid-2020s?
I'd like to have a Cab Franc vineyard and some more Pinot Gris. And just a little higher volume than where we are now.
Yeah.
So now we're sort of bounced between 1500 and 2000, and it'd be nice to sort of be bouncing between 2000 and 25. So still small enough that, Mary and I can, more or less do things without too many employees.
Which is important.
But enough that we can hire a few people so that we can take a break once in a while. That's really the vision.
So you don't wake up in the morning in so much pain.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Actually, we start off by talking about your favorite style. It's not as much California. It's a little bit lighter, lower alcohol, a little bit fresher, cooler climate. I wonder if there's going to be more, and I've talked about this before, I wonder if there's going to be more people flocking to areas like Prince Edward County as younger people want more fresh, more low alcohol wines. And with climate change, that makes other popular areas, it's going to be hard for them not to hit 15 and 15 and a half for a lot of their dry reds.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's probably true. And yeah, so, hopefully, as people taste more and more of the wines from places like the county, they realize how good they are and how good they are with the food. And so, yeah, I'm hoping that that definitely happens.
Where can people find you? Websites. The great thing about here is if you're driving, getting off of 401 and you're heading towards, you know, the heart of wine country, Prince Edward County, yours is one of the first signs I always see. It's one of the first times I came here about a decade ago. I'm like, oh, let's go try there. How can people find you?
So we're just off of Station Road, off of the main Highway 33. So you turn on Station and you'll come to our tasting room. You can find us online at stannersvineyard.com. We're also on social media. We sell our wines in a number of restaurants in Toronto and Ottawa, so you'll probably see some there. And we're in a few stores, a few LCBO stores.
I see you every now and then. It's you guys.
Yeah. So our regular Pinot Noir is in some stores in the LCBO, and so is our Chardonnay.
Colin, really appreciate you taking time on this Sunday morning to chat with me. I, as I said, I'm a big fan of your wines, and I love what you guys do, and I appreciate you taking an hour out of your day.
Oh, thanks very much. It was fun talking with you.
Oh, good. Thank you so much, Colin. This has been the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, find me Stitcher, Spotify, iTunes, iHeart, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.